The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. Find and replace Everton and Aston Villa with Southampton. The Saints score four at Villa with James, the new Letizia Ward-Prowse, pulling the strings. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's one game on, one game off policy continues as United lose to Arsenal, for whom Thomas Partey is the answer for now. Bale is back and Spurs are second. Meanwhile, why can't foreigners like Mo Salah stay on their feet like Harry Kane? We'll congratulate Manchester City on winning the Women's FA Cup and take a look at the Championship. When did Reading get good? All that, your questions, and of course we will pay tribute to Nobby Styles, World Cup winner who's died at the age of 78. And that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Barry Glendenning. Hello.
Hello, Max.
Hello, Marcus Bean.
Hi, Max, mate. How you doing?
I'm good. I think my Wi-Fi is the worst it's been. It's lockdown too. It's doing this to me. Philippe Auclair, can you see and hear me?
Just about, Max. I'm very happy I'm doing so.
I don't know if I can bear it with how... Everyone's on such a delay for me. And do you know what's funny is I feel like you're all shit, right? Because I can hear myself. Why can't you just answer me when I've asked you the stupid question? Anyway, Jay-Z says, is it wrong that I'm bored of football, but I look forward to the football podcasts? When football is a pure product, it's boring. Well, I suppose we would rather it was that way round, that you enjoy the podcasts at least. Let's begin, Barry, at Villa Park, Aston Villa 3, Southampton 4. A point of order, I don't think we can call this a seven-goal thriller, Barry, because it went 4-0 to 4-3, but it was still probably the most entertaining game of the weekend.
Yeah, there wasn't a huge number of entertaining games this week. It certainly doesn't fall into the bracket of a thriller because the Southampton win, I don't think, was ever in any doubt. Possibly for 15 seconds after Aston Villa scored their third and before the final whistle went. But not a thriller, but a very entertaining game. And Southampton were hugely impressive, and they have been increasingly impressive after getting off to a pretty shaky start to the season. I'm trying to figure out what the key to their success is. I think they're sharing the goals around more. Earlier in the season, Ralph Hasenhüttl was playing a really, really high line with full backs pushed forward. I think he was actually playing five at the back with wing backs pushed way forward, and the centre backs were getting done for speed. I think that's what happened to them when they got mullered by Tottenham. They press high up the pitch. They work hard. James Ward-Prowse seems to be coming into the form of his life. There were times last season when he was off the ball. I don't think anyone doubts he's a good player. Scored two brilliant free kicks yesterday. And they do seem to be a force to be reckoned with.
He's overtaken Letizia as the player with the most free kick goals for Southampton, which I think was the most interesting stat I could find of the weekend. Well, I didn't find it, but the one that was put in front of me of the weekend. I wrote his first free kick was Beckham v Greece, and then I wrote his second free kick was Beckham v Greece. How highly should we rate him, Marcus?
I think his strengths are definitely his set-piece taking. I think as a midfielder, he's okay. He's good. He's a solid Premier League player, but I think that his set-piece taking takes him over the line to being a very good player. Just from Villa's point of view, I think I'm guessing all week they should have been working on not giving away fouls outside the edge of the box, because that's what happens. It's an unfortunate game for them where it's three unbelievable goals that have sealed it for Southampton, but you definitely can't give away silly free kicks around the box with Ward-Prowse about.
I think it's interesting, Marcus, you say he's okay. I mean, in my mind, that means you think he's rubbish.
Oh, no, I don't think he's rubbish. I think he's just a good player. You know, I don't think he's an amazing player. I think but the set piece taking is, as we know, the importance of set pieces in football and the growing importance of them. And if you've got somebody that can take set pieces like that, you know, whether it be corners or free kicks, then it's a massive plus for your team.
Philippe, who's your favourite free kick taker of all time?
Oh, Juninho Pernambucano. I don't think there's any doubt on that. I think it's probably the greatest free kick taker of all time, I would say. And certainly, statistically, I think he is. But also, the way he whacked them from 35 yards is something quite different from the delicate art of whipping it over the wall and into the corner. Juninho could do that, but he could also just hit a thunder bastard from 35 yards as well. So He has to be. What's yours, Max?
Ah, I don't really like being asked the questions. That's a good... I would have had you down as someone who only went for subtlety, Philly.
But he could go.
I mean,
he could go for subtlety.
I'm biased, but Glenn Hoddle...
He could go for subtlety. Yeah, and okay. You should have expected me to say Michel Platini, because if you think about it, the first, I would say, world-class player who genuinely trademarked the free kick as being one of the principal weapons in his armoury was Michel Platini. And the number of crazily important goals he scored for France in particular on direct free kicks against Holland, against Spain, in the final of Euro 1984, and in so many other occasions, he probably is the first. Actually, he's the first player I can remember who was filmed practicing free kicks, you know, with silhouettes on the training pitch. And I can't think of any other who was doing that before him. So maybe it's complete French mythology. Were there other free kick takers who were already doing this?
Barry, do you think James Ward-Prowse might actually end up being more useful for Southampton than Matt Le Tissier? Or is that sacrilege to even say that out loud?
Well, I haven't yet heard his views on global warming or Brexit. And until I do, I will reserve judgment. I mean, Matt Le Tissier is my favourite player of all time, ever. In it, you know, just straight away, there's no contest. But, and I've met him several times, and I think he's a very nice man, but he does have some political and environmental views that I'm not entirely on board with. I don't know what James Ward feels about these things, but I would need to find out before I decide whether or not he'll be more useful to Southampton than Tiss was.
A question from Grant. Already know Barry's answer, but I'll ask the others. I'm a Villa fan. Are we shit again?
No, I honestly think that was one of those freak games where, you know, where a team scores three goals that you can't do much about. I quite like Villa. I think they're going to have a really solid season. And yeah, you're not shit at the moment.
I mean, if you look, Max... shots on target in this game, Aston Villa had 10 to Southampton's 4. So Southampton had 4 shots on target, 4 goals. Villa had 11 corners to Southampton's 1. So just looking at the bare statistics, that's pretty decent. There was one thing, actually, I wanted to ask Marcus, and possibly to a lesser extent you, Max, because you do still play football. But the guys on Match of the Day 2 noticed the thing. I hadn't noticed. I'm not very good at noticing these kind of things. But just that, where Southampton's wingers come inside and the strikers go outside, and it sort of bamboozles the defenders. They don't know how to deal with it. Would that be a very confusing thing to happen on the pitch? And is this a revolutionary tactic by Ralf Hasenhüttl?
I think it's different. And I do think these kind of differences in tactical play do make a difference. If you look at when Sheffield United first started playing the three at the back and then the centre-halves overlapping, that caused all sorts of problems. I think as soon as teams start figuring out what Southampton do and they start working on that throughout the week, I do think they'll be able to handle it a lot easier. But yeah, these differences in tactical play do make a difference, I think, especially in the short term.
While I appreciate you asking me that question as well, Barry, it's worth pointing out, I don't let my players go to training because I don't want the first team to nick them. So as a side who don't ever train, it's quite hard to develop any sort of tactics apart from turn their fullbacks. Philippe, you had your hand up.
No, it's just about Southampton, you know, about those first two games of the season. I think it's not by chance that you see that the results started to improve or improved immediately when Hasenhüttl actually got his back four sorted out. It had already been the problem last season, I remember, when he was constantly chopping and changing and wondering what his best combination was. And Southampton really struggled, as you will remember, to kick off the last season. This time, I don't think I'm mistaken in saying it's been the same back four, back five, since the third game of the season, which is when things started to really click together. So he's got the structure is there, the spine is in place, and let's hope it stays in place, because I don't know if you got news about Danny Ings, but it looked a little bit concerning.
And that Vestergaard header was an absolutely brilliant It was a brilliant header. The bravery you need and the composure, and it's all happening very quickly. I love to see that. Let's go to Old Trafford, then Manchester United 0, Arsenal 1. Tim says, would it be better to replace all future Manchester United Arsenal games with a random replay of a previous game from the 90s, early 2000s, when they mattered and were interesting? Brackets, disclaimer, this was posted at halftime, still time for it to spring into life. And Troy says, regarding the Ole paradox, beating class teams and losing to mediocre ones, does Arsenal victory confirm that Arsenal are, in fact, a crap side? Their first league win at Old Trafford in 14 years. United's third loss in 6 games, all 3 defeats at home. Philippe, Arsenal were really good, weren't they? And El Nene and Thomas Partey were brilliant as well.
El Nene, Partey, Bellerin, I think you could go through almost the whole team. Lacazette did a huge amount of work up front as well. Are we supposed to answer the questions? Because I actually enjoyed that game, strangely enough, but maybe it has to do with my club loyalties. This might explain that. I don't think it shows that Arsenal are a crap team, by the way. It probably shows more that PSG, for example, is a crap team. That certainly is a proposal that I can agree with. But otherwise, it was, I think, quite a superb performance by Arsenal from the word go. The lack of reaction from Manchester United was quite worrying, I suppose, for people who like them and wish them well. And there was actually not a single moment during the game when I really felt that they threatened anything, which is very odd. And I guess a lot of the talk has been about the tactical setup, the diamond, the fact that Ole Gunnar Solskjaer doesn't have a definite structure to make them play in, the fact that he doesn't know how to shoehorn all his star players in the same system. But the problem seemed to be one of, of belief. It's very odd that they didn't react until when they started to throw everything into the blender in the last 5-10 minutes or something like that. It's very concerning. And by the way, people who keep talking about Arsenal not winning at Old Trafford since 2006 and the Adebayor goal, if you look at the last results between the two teams, there's actually a pattern which is starting to emerge now. Actually, Arsenal have been doing rather well against Manchester United for the last couple of seasons.
Philippe, can I ask about Thomas Partey? Like, Arsenal fans have been desperate to find a new Vieira or Gilberto, and it's Guendouzi for 5 minutes and Torreira for 5 minutes, etc., etc., etc. Do you, like, he hasn't been there long, but he does look great. And I know we've said it before about other central midfielders for Arsenal.
He looks absolutely magnificent. And in a way, he also looks, I don't know it's because of the way Arteta plays. Obviously, everybody rated him very, very highly at Atletico. And the way that Simeone was furious when he realised that Arsenal had gazumped him is a proof of that. But the Thomas Partey we've seen in those few games, especially in the game against Manchester United, seems to me more involved in creating than he is or was usually with Atletico de Madrid. So he's got perhaps a more proactive role in that team. So you see yet another facet of his whole game, which is made possible because he's got next to him one of the most disciplined midfielders that Arsenal can count on, which is Mohamed Elneny, who had absolutely fantastic game. But yes, I mean, he's one of those transformative players, but he's not Vieira, he's not Petit, he's not Gilberto Silva. He's more dynamic, I would say, than two of these three. But he's also box to box. And yes, I mean, people are kind of pinching themselves, wondering, well, by chance, would we be able to actually sign the right people now? And in his case, it looks that's the case, yes.
He's like a modern-day Marcus Bean, Thomas Partey. I do think, even though it's pronounced Partey, I do really think anyone of a certain age should say party, because it just sounds like Martin Tyler is trying to sound down with the kids by saying Partey. And there's something about it that makes me cringe every time it says his name. Marcus, what did you make of the game?
I thought that Arsenal were very good. Excellent. I think Arteta has got them playing well defensively. We know that they're a lot more solid. I think he saw that. He understood from before that defensively they were poor, and he's improved on that. And always been the problem with Arsenal under Arteta has been chance creation, and I thought they were creating some good chances against United. From United's point of view, I think one of the big problems they have and have had under Solskjaer is that they struggle to break down teams who are good defensively and playing a low block. And again, that showed again against Arsenal, and there's big problems at Man United at the moment.
Barry, Hugh says, can any of the panellists name one aspect of Paul Pogba's games that's improved since he joined United? I mean, that it was a terrible penalty to give away, wasn't it?
Yeah, he didn't track. It was Bellerin's run and then stuck out his leg and brought him down. I mean, he knew straight away the way he hit the ground in frustration that he had given away a penalty. He didn't even attempt to protest his innocence. I think he's been dreadful for Manchester United largely. So he does have people who stick up for him. For the amount of money they paid, I think they would be better off without him. I think Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, if anything, has too many options in midfield. He doesn't know what his best midfield is, and I think if he had fewer options, it might be better for him. And Pogba, I think they wouldn't miss him if he left. I'm not sure who. Obviously, teams would want him. I'm not sure how much Manchester United would get for him at this point, but you would have to say his time there has been pretty...
Underwhelming?
Underwhelming, yes. Thank you, Philippe.
Well, if you say, has he improved? If I look at him with the French team, he has improved. Well, you know, that's the bizarre thing. So obviously it's a problem of fitting in a particular team, fitting in a particular club, fitting in a particular system, even though I think the bit of the system is a bit of a red herring. I'm sure that he can play in a number of positions and play equally well. He can play as almost as a supporting striker. He can play as a 10. He can play as a left-sided number 8. He can play as a wing-back. He can play in so many positions. It's just not happening. And is it the case of Manchester United having too good a squad, if that doesn't sound too paradoxical? Is that they've got an awful lot of very, very good players, but none of whom seems to be able to dovetail into the other's game. So, and because of that, you're in a situation when you've got... I mean, Fred is a very decent player. McTominay is a very good player. Bruno Fernandes is an excellent player. Paul Pogba is a world champion. You carry on like that. You go through the whole squad, certainly midfield and attack. But there are too many options, in a way. So maybe, as Barry said, they would be better by just... leaving him out, doing an Ozil. It's funny, we're not talking about Mesut Ozil, are we?
While we're on Manchester United, let's pay tribute to Nobby Stiles, former United legend, had prostate cancer, advanced dementia. He won 28 caps for England. He played a key role in keeping Eusebio quiet in the 1966 semi-final before obviously playing in the win over West Germany and dancing on the pitch. Jeff Hurst said, great character, the heart and soul of the team. He'll be sorely missed. He won two league titles and the European Cup during 11 years with Manchester United, going on to play for Middlesbrough and Preston before retiring in 1975. Moved into management at Preston between 77 and 81. Had a brief spell in charge of West Brom during the 85-86 season. He's the seventh of the 11 men to win the World Cup to leave us. Barry, I know you spoke to Mark Lawrenson over the weekend about Nobby Stiles, the man.
Yeah, I helped him do a column for The Observer, and he spoke to me for about half an hour on Saturday morning. I think he was on his way to BBC to pay homage to Nobby on Football Focus. And Lauro had Nobby as his coach at Preston when he was, as he described himself, a lanky, gangly teenage right winger with no right foot. Although in print this was transformed somewhere along the process as a gangly, lanky left winger with no left foot. Well, whatever it was, he said Nobby saw something in him and brought him back. You know, said, I think they were 4-0 down against Villa reserves in a game and at half time. And Nobby said, look, why don't you come back and play in defence with me? Nobby had made about 50 appearances for Preston, signed by his mate and old teammate, Bobby Charlton, who was manager. And then towards the end of his career, he was given the job of basically playing in the reserves and trying to bring a couple of teenagers through to play in the Preston first team. Preston would have been the second or third division at this time. And Lauro said that that day changed his life. And if it wasn't, you know, Lauro was a very distinguished centre half, very elegant player, had huge success, left Preston for Brighton and then went to Liverpool, with whom he won lots of stuff, including a European Cup. But he said that without Nobby Styles, he would have achieved absolutely nothing in the game. He would have probably just either dropped out of it or been a journeyman around the lower leagues. And he said Nobby, as a bloke, couldn't have been nicer. He was very supportive of his players. As long as they worked hard, he was willing to overlook a lack of ability. He looked after them on the pitch, because they'd be playing these reserves matches against grizzled old pros. And if any of them were taking liberties, Nobby would, in the words of Lauro, cut them in half. He'd sort them right out. And he also apparently had this disconcerting habit / superstition of getting ready for matches by putting on his socks, his boots, his jersey, but no shorts or underwear, and wandering around the dressing room trying to G up the players while they all sort of tried to avoid looking at him and, yeah, being a little freaked out. But this was his pre-match superstition. But once he got his shorts on, he'd go, and before kickoff, he'd have a word with the ref, you know, you look after my players because they're my little babies, they're only kids, and if they start getting kicked around, I want you to intervene, ref. And because of his standing in the game, refs would go, oh, yes, Nobby, of course, I'll look after them. So he just seems to be a thoroughly nice guy, and it's a shame what happened to him. Alzheimer's is an absolute bastard of a disease. I have a good friend whose mum has been suffering it for years. She just lies in bed unconscious all the time, doesn't know what's going on. And Lauro said he knows Nobby's son quite well, and while they're obviously devastated to lose Nobby, it's almost a release at this stage.
Before we talk about Alzheimer's and dementia, Philippe, Nobby Styles was loved sort of beyond these shores, wasn't he?
Yes, I mean, the image of Nobby Styles is not necessarily the same, you know, outside of England as it is in England. And I mean, in France, obviously, there's one thing which in his career, which people haven't forgotten, even though it happened a very, very long time ago. It was his horrendous tackle on Jackie Simon in the 1966 World Cup, which basically took Simon out of the tournament and France out of the tournament because England scored. And you might remember, you might know that in England itself, people were asking for Nobby Styles to be kicked out of the England team because of that foul. And it was only because Alf Ramsey intervened personally and said, I will never accept that I have to leave Nobby Styles out. I will never take him out of the team. And he stood by his player, and in England went on to win the World Cup. And it was at the time it was a scandal. I mean, if I can bring my grain of salt, I knew him a little bit because he was my go-to Manchester United player when I started with France Football. And I was told, oh, if you want to talk about the great 60s team and so forth, you want to talk about England, there's one guy who's really, really nice. And I would phone Nobby Styles at his home, and he would always take the call and regale me and our readers with stories about his great Manchester United side and about the England national team. Always willing to have a word, until unfortunately the disease started to hit, and this awful disease which has now taken is it five players from the 1966 World Cup team?
Max, you spoke there about him, the man-marking job he did in Eusebio in the World Cup semi-final in 66. But Alf Ramsey, before the game or at the team meeting, said, you know, right, Nobby, this Eusebio, I want you to take him out of the game. To which Nobby replied, what, forever?
By all accounts, he was a bloody good footballer at the same time. You mentioned, we talk about, you know, dementia and Alzheimer's. You know, the day after Sir Bobby Charlton, it was announced that he's been diagnosed with dementia. He's 83, the fifth member of the 66 World Cup winning side to be diagnosed with it, in addition to Nobby. And to Bobby's brother Jack, Martin Peters, Ray Wilson also had the condition. A study by Glasgow University in 2019 found former professional footballers are 3.5 times more likely to die of dementia than people at the same age range in the general population. Andy Dunn wrote a piece in The Mirror saying if the games authorities really want to pay an important, far-reaching tribute to such an inspirational figure as Nobby Styles, they should finally show some urgency in getting to the bottom of the links between football and dementia and Alzheimer's, which claimed Nobby's life. I don't know what you think, Marcus. The PFA, I mean, it gives $125,000 a year to dementia research each year, but it just doesn't, it doesn't feel right to me.
No, it's not right. I think more needs to be done from the PFA side. That the amount of money being invested is far below what's required. But saying that, it's not just the PFA's job. It's all the stakeholders in the game. It's the football clubs. It's the FA. If you look across the pond in the NFL, the amount of money that's been compensated or invested for these head injuries and head repetitive head injuries is far outweighs what's happening in the football league. So more needs to be done by all stakeholders, and the PFA should be at the front of that because they are the our union, and they should be the ones that have our best interests at heart.
It's quite a personal question, I imagine, Marcus, but do you think about how much you've headed at football?
I do. It's actually weird because I've also got a very bad memory. Mrs. always tells me off, miss anniversaries, birthdays. Well, I don't. That's a bit of exaggeration, but I miss a lot. I forget lots of stuff, and I always wonder. Is that because, you know, a couple of concussions I've had or repetitive heading the ball, and what the FA have done, which is great, is the young kids, and they're not letting them head the ball. I think it's till 16 or something like that, or minimal heading of the ball until 16. But when I was growing up, heading was a staple of any sort of training we used to do from the age of like probably 8. These are things that play on your mind, and I'm really sorry for anyone, all the families that have to care for and look after these players, because it is very tough.
The reason why over the pond people have been far more active is, I believe, because there's been a class action. And obviously, if there's a class action, it's a completely different ball game because we're talking about compensation. And also, they've been researching this matter for much, much longer. But what is strange and actually a bit worrying is that I think that the UK is the only country in Europe which is taking it seriously. I was looking at this before the podcast, wondering what is it in Spain, in Italy, in Germany, you know, in France, in the big, you know, football countries in Europe. And the answer is that there's absolutely no research whatsoever. None. And from time to time, you hear that a player has fallen victim. I know of one great French player, won't give his name, but who suffers from the disease, but it's not in the open. And there must be many, many others. But it seems that England and Scotland, because the University of Glasgow was involved in that, and Wales, University of Swansea as well, is the only place in world football today, in soccer, where this is actually taken seriously. And you actually wonder, because we talk about the PFA and the FA, if the matter should not also be of interest to UEFA and FIFA, because there are funds in those confederations. But I'm not aware of the fact that these studies are being conducted. And my apologies to both UEFA and FIFA if that's the case and we haven't heard about it. But certainly we could actually expand the scope of the research beyond the English and the Scottish game, and that doesn't seem to be the case at the moment.
Okay, that'll do for part one. Part two will begin at Anfield. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Jack says, not a question, can you shout out my mum Hillary for getting me a ticket for next Monday's live show? I didn't ask for it. She just saw the advert and knew it would be the sort of hipster lefty stuff I love. Me, Barry, Jonathan Wilson, Barney Roney, perfectly timed to coincide with lockdown too, Barry. £6 couldn't be spent better, could it?
No, I don't think so. I'm not sure. We're certainly lefty. I don't know about hipstery. I have no plans to do the show while toing and froing on a unicycle while wearing a monocle and a fez. But I'm looking forward to it immensely. And it perhaps one of the very few benefits of lockdown 2 is that We shall hopefully shift a few more tickets because we have a captive audience.
Absolutely. And the tickets are running out fast. But since everyone on Earth can get one, they won't sell out until we get 6 billion, which would be useful. Anyway, come along. It will be fun. Liverpool 2, West Ham 1. Liverpool the top of the league, extending their unbeaten home league run to 63 games, matching their best run from December 1980. Came from behind to win for the third game in a row, beating West Ham 2-1. People are trying to claim controversy over both their goals. The penalty, Masuaku on Salah, which was Liverpool's only shot in the first half. David Moyes said, "It's not the way I see football, and it's not the sort of football I want to be involved in." He threw himself to the ground. Arthur thought the referee was going to do something about Salah throwing himself to the ground, but it went the other way. I thought, Barry, he just kicked his foot. I thought it was a penalty.
Well, it can be a foul, and he can throw himself to the ground theatrically, and that's what happened. The reaction to the foul was completely over the top. I don't like to see it, but it seems to be a staple of the game. If I had a son or daughter playing football and they did that, I would have a word with them. But it was a foul.
Marcus, I mean, presumably, you know, have you ever, when you got kicked, did you go down, or were you, do you only go to ground if you absolutely had no other option?
I think the issue here is if he stays up, you know, is he going to get the foul? I think until they start giving penalties when players stay on their feet, then this is never going to get resolved. It's a definite foul, but he has to go down to get the penalty. Otherwise, he stays up and retains possession. I think nothing's given. So I think that's where the big issue lies.
Tom is a West Ham fan. He says, if you're stood in the middle of the 18-yard box and have the ball passed towards you, are you interfering with play? I don't know if Tom is objective in the second goal. A lovely ball from Shaqiri. Jota's running through. Mane's standing still. There's no controversy there, Philippe, is there?
According to the letter of the law, absolutely no controversy. He's not interfering with play as the law states it, but he's interfering with play. That's what I would say. I'm saying the law is an ass, that's all. But it is the law, and the decision was the correct one, by the way. No, otherwise, for goodness sake, what's going to happen to me? Oh, dear. You know, what Marcus was saying, in all my years of watching football, I've only seen one example of a player staying on his feet and being given a penalty. That was Conor Wickham playing for Sunderland when Gus Poyet was the manager, and the ref, there was a foul on Wickham. He still managed to get his shot away, but the shot went wide of the post. And the ref said, no, there was a foul, that's a pen. It's the only time I've seen it. So, and that's a problem. That's a huge problem. How many times? I think there was there have been plenty of occasions when we've seen that this season, when the refs are not giving the pens. I don't quite understand that.
Nathaniel Phillips played well in central defence alongside Joe Gomez. He's got the look of a League Two centre-back, Phillips. I was lovely to see him playing for Liverpool. And West Ham are impressive, aren't they? At 1-1, you know, Fornals is through, and if he just squares it to Jared Bowen, it's just a definite, they take the lead again. You know, Liverpool, Marcus, I know they're your team. They're not playing well, but they're winning and they're top of the league. And in this season, wherever it goes, anything could happen. The anything that's going to happen is Liverpool are probably going to win the league.
Yeah, I think that game, West Ham, if they have Mikel Antonio up front, is even harder, tougher for Liverpool, and you wonder whether they come away with the points. Haller is you know, he offers very little. That's a big waste of money, it looks like, at this moment in time. And Liverpool defensively have been poor since a restart, since the first lockdown. Needs to improve defensively if they're going to have a chance of winning the league. We can't concede goals at the rate that we currently are and expect to win a title, even with the front three we have up front.
Spurs 2, Brighton 1. Probably Spurs' least convincing performance at home in the league and their first win at the home in the league. Gareth Bale's header, great ball from Aldevira, Reguilon with a decent cross. I was delighted, obviously I'm biased, but just really happy for Gareth Bale. Barry, were you happy for Gareth Bale?
I suppose. I haven't seen him score many goals with his head. Was it? No, it didn't really make my day. I had a nice dinner yesterday, which made me more happy than seeing Gareth Bale score. I went for a couple of pints and a neighbour had a fireworks display. They both made me more happy than Gareth Bale's winner. So I have to, on the balance of things, say I was completely indifferent to Gareth Bale's scoring winner. But, you know, he seems a nice enough lad. Good luck to him.
Bart says, did Bale congratulate Reguilon in Spanish? He did. He went, vamos. He could speak it all along. Meanwhile, 149 goals for Harry Kane moves him 10th into the Premier League all-time top scorers. Is that a foul by Lallana on Kane or a foul by Kane on Lallana, Marcus?
100% a foul by Kane on Lallana. He's looked over his shoulder. He's not gone for the ball and he's just backed into Adam Lallana. I think it's an awful decision, to be honest. And yeah, some sort of disciplinary action has to go against the referee there. You can't make mistakes like that. Anyone who plays the game knows that as soon as you have a look at the defender and anywhere else on the pitch, this normally is given for a foul. You have a look over your shoulder, you back in, it's a foul to the on Lallana for me. And I think it's really poor decision. And I thought over on the balance of play, I thought Brighton were probably the better side. I still think there's work to be done by Mourinho at Spurs.
Not only is it a foul, it's a very dangerous foul. And yeah. Kane has form for this because he did it the exact same thing. One that springs to mind is against West Ham and Aaron Cresswell. He had a good look, saw that Cresswell was about to jump and then backed into the space where Cresswell was going to land, ensuring that Cresswell landed on his shoulder. And then in rugby, that's a spear tackle. That's a straight red card and a very long ban. In Aussie rules, it's called tunnelling, also been outlawed. It is very, very dangerous because the player Kane does that to is almost certainly going to land on their shoulder or their head and could conceivably break their neck.
While we're on refereeing decisions, what did you make of Graham Scott being the first ever referee to go to a monitor and stick with his decision about Solly March on Højbjerg? Was that a foul or was that not a foul, Marcus?
I think that's a foul. I think generally those are given. I think the argument is that he got a fraction of his studs on the ball, which he might have done or he probably did, but he's come through the back of him. It's a tackle from behind-ish. And 90% of the time that's given, I'm very surprised that when he went to look at the monitor with the slow modes and different angles, he still came up with the same decision. And yeah, Tottenham can feel very hard done by that goal.
Jose said, I miss my old football. I miss my old football. Brackets with goal line technology, close brackets. I miss my old football. The Tottenham Hotspur Supporters Trust, the latest set of fans to boycott pay-per-view and put their money instead to a food bank. They raised £42,000, so well done to them. Brighton, Barry, probably the better side in this without creating too much.
Well, that's Brighton's problem. They're very good going forward. They pass well, they move well, but they're just lacking in cutting edge up front and finding goals very hard to come by. And interestingly, yesterday, there was no Neil Maupay or Aaron Connolly in their squad. I'm not sure why. I think Graham Potter said it was for tactical reasons, in the case of Maupay at least, but it seemed weird that a team that is struggling for goals leaves the two players most likely to score them out of their squad. So they had Leandro Trossard up front with Adam Lallana and Gross behind him, and they drew another blank, so it's quite concerning for them.
To Turf Moor, Burnley 0, Chelsea 3. Ben Ross says, are those at Guardian Towers slightly concerned that Frank Lampard's Chelsea might actually be able to defend now they've signed a functioning goalkeeper? they played well, Chelsea, didn't they, Philippe?
They played well, but Burnley were awful. I'm sorry, I shouldn't laugh and say Burnley were awful. Sorry, Burnley fans. Yes, they were quite convincing. Interesting team selection as well by Frank Lampard, and with Hakim Ziyech making, you know, immediate impact as well. But again, I'm a bit loath to draw too much out of it, because again, Burnley are in a really, really bad spot at the moment. They're completely unrecognizable from the side we saw. Well, last season actually they had their problems too, but they reacted very well, and this is becoming actually very very worrying for them, especially when you add to that all the rumors about the possible takeover of the club, and the fact that, you know, obviously Sean Dyche is not too happy. I actually spoke to him for Frost Football just before the season started, and actually when I'm thinking of what he was talking to me about, at the time, I realized I was perhaps more than I understood. And he was talking about the cautiousness of his board in terms of recruitment. And I'm now thinking, oh, what he meant is not the cautiousness, the fact that basically they're really very close to their money and they don't want to spend. It's perhaps because the club has already, or the owners of the club have already in mind the idea of selling it on. And obviously they don't want to invest too much money when they know they're going to part with the club. So, and all of this you put together, you think, oh, that's not really good. And I know you were talking about Chelsea, but you've got to think of the adversary, of the rival of the day. And that rival is, I wouldn't say in disarray, that would be too strong a word, but it's not doing well at all.
Marcus, I thought that I was really interested to see how Thiago Silva did against Barnes and Wood and sort of Burnley's direct style. I thought it might be the undoing of him, but I was completely wrong. He's a talented young lad, isn't he, Thiago Silva?
Yeah, these sort of direct play for players of that quality is food and drink. You know, they read the ball, they read the game. They've got so much time to see the ball travelling over long distances and clean up. It's easy for them, for players like him. I think where he might struggle is with fast movement, quick interplay with his aging legs, maybe. But yeah, reading the game is, without a shadow of a doubt, is going to be easy for Thiago Silva. I think what Lampard's done over the last few weeks is address the defensive problems. You can tell that he's been working on that on the training ground. They look a lot more solid as a unit. Granted, Burnley aren't the most attacking potent threat, but it does look like there's been work done. And Mendy looks like an upgrade on Kepa.
Barry, I don't know if you saw Ian Wone's interview in The Athletic, which spoke about Sean Dyche's visit to the Grand Canyon. They take trips together, Wone and Dyche, including one to Las Vegas. During it, they decided to drive 6 hours to see the Grand Canyon. Dyche was unable to get insurance, so Wone did all the driving during the 12-hour round trip. "We got to this incredible place," says Wone. He looked over the rim for 2 minutes and said, "All right, I've seen it, let's go." I said to him, "You've got to be kidding me." He just looked at me and said, "I've seen it. What else have I got to see? I'm just looking at this big hole."
I mean, Max, I'm a big fan of the travel writer Bill Bryson, and his description of the Grand Canyon is nothing prepares you for the Grand Canyon. No matter how many times you read about it or see it in pictures, it still takes your breath away. Your mind unable to deal with anything on this scale just shuts down, and for many long moments, you're a human vacuum without speech or breath, just a deep, inexpressible awe that anything on this earth could be so vast, so beautiful. The scale is almost incomprehensible. It is 10 miles across, a mile deep, 180 miles long, blah, blah, blah. And then you get Sean Dyche going, "Well, it's just a hole."
It's a big hole. I'm with Dyche, eh? Sheffield United 0, Man City 1. Not a classic. City ground it out. Kyle Walker scored against his hometown club on his 100th Premier League start for City. He's playing really well at the moment, Kyle Walker, isn't he, Mark?
Yeah, Kyle Walker's in excellent form, whether it be for England or for Man City. And he's a player that's improved immensely over the years, in my opinion, under Guardiola. And he looks like a really good, complete fullback who's able to defend and give good attacking output as well.
Ferran Torres looks pretty good to me. Playing up top, not his natural position. 1 point in 7 games for Sheffield United, Philippe. I was chatting to a guy called Johnny Gascoigne, who does the Shoreham View of Sheffield United podcast, about second season syndrome. And he pointed out it's not really a thing. I think it's only Ipswich, who had a brilliant season and then went down. Teams have obviously gone down in their second season before. But what do you make of Sheffield United's start?
Unfortunately, not entirely surprised by what happened. A lot of Sheffield United's success last season was due to both an element of surprise, which is no longer there. I mean, Marcus was talking about the new system that they were playing with, which actually threw some teams and made it very difficult for other teams to know how to parry that. Now I think teams have done their homework. That's the first thing. Second thing, they haven't necessarily strengthened the team as it should be. Third, they've lost a very important player in Henderson, who was very often the difference between a draw and a win, or between a loss and a draw last season. You put all that together and you add a pretty bad dynamic in terms of results and things not going exactly their way as they did, you know, last season. And all of this put together means that the doubts we had about Sheffield United and the difficult second album are shown to be true. So they've got to react very, very quickly. Have they got the resources for that? And it's by no way, trying to say, we inflated, our view of Chris Wilder, what he achieved was inflated and was not. No, what they did was wonderful. But unfortunately, the ingredients perhaps are not quite there anymore for them to do anything of the kind this season. And you should be worried about them, yes.
Newcastle United 2, Everton 1. This is more like it from Everton, the Everton we know and love. What are Newcastle, Barry? I mean, even in victory, they appear sort of stultifyingly boring.
We have this conversation every week. I think Steve Bruce is doing a good job. I think they're boring to watch. And lots of Newcastle fans think he's awful. That was a good win.
cut and paste for Newcastle victories. And then when Newcastle lose, we'll cut and paste 20 seconds of Barry as well. Callum Wilson's been a decent signing, hasn't he? He got both goals. Marcus, what did you make of Jordan Pickford being rested / dropped for this game?
Yeah, Carlo Ancelotti's explanation didn't really fly with me. It's very unusual for any manager to drop a keeper that's doing well. So he's obviously not happy with some sort of form of his performances. And he said he's going to be back in for the next game, but I'm not too convinced he will be. He said it on live on TV, so the likelihood is he will. But the replacement done quite well. Pickford hasn't been great, so why wouldn't you stick with the replacement?
Wolves 2, Crystal Palace 0. Palace had one ruled out before Wolves got going. They're now up to fifth. Your Champions League prediction for Wolves looks healthier than it did a few weeks ago, Baz. And a bad day for Milivojevic, who had the ball on the spot to take a penalty before VAR said, no, it's not a penalty, there was an offside, and then got sent off for one of those. I'm going to get in trouble again. But I don't want to sound like a dinosaur, and I think it is a red card, but I do think it's sort of unlucky if you follow through. I mean, Marcus, you must have done that, right? You get the ball with a tackle and then you follow through, and it might be a red, but it's sort of unlucky red. Does that make sense, or am I wrong again? Am I going to get pilloried?
No, I agree with you. I've probably made many a tackle like that before VAR, and probably would have got sent off a lot of times. I think with the introduction of VAR, you are going to see a lot more red cards, because that one, it's high and he's got the ball cleanly, but it's a bit too high and he has to go. But I agree with you, it's harsh.
Palace 3 points off the Champions League places, or in low and mid-table, depending if you're an optimist or a Palace fan. And that'll do for part two. Part three, Flo Lloyd-Hughes will join us, and we'll talk about Manchester City winning the Women's FA Cup. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Let's talk about the Women's FA Cup final and a bit of the EFL. Flo Lloyd-Hughes joins us. Hey, Flo, how are you?
I'm all right, Max. How are you?
Very good. You tweeted yesterday, my eight-year-old self would be very excited to be on a podcast with Marcus Bean. My present-day self is also looking forward to it. Are you less excited right now than eight-year-old Flo? Will you be able to keep yourself together while Marcus Bean is looking at you?
I will try and keep myself composed. I will try my very best, but, it's going to be difficult.
What did you make of this game then? Man City were taken to extra time. I mean, the Everton goalkeeper, Sandy McGuire, was superb in this game.
Yeah, it was a fantastic final. I think one of the best Women's FA Cup finals we've had in a while. Even more so the fact that it's kind of leftovers from last season. So they're doing two FA Cups this season because of the suspension of the league, because of COVID. So actually the level at which both teams were playing, coming off the back of an international break, of which a lot of England players didn't even really play because their game against Germany got cancelled. So the level was really good, really competitive. And I feel for Everton because, Sandy McIver put up such an immense performance in goal, and Valerie Govan, who looked like she wasn't going to play the second half after she had a pretty hard challenge from Steph Horton. She was limping. She came back and then got the equaliser for Everton. And unfortunately, they just couldn't hold on in extra time, and City scored two. And I think that quality just shone through in the end. But it's exciting for Everton because they've obviously got another FA Cup to fight for, League Cup, Conti Cup and the league. So they've still got a lot to play for. But it was a really fantastic final.
I'm not sure I've seen a team look so sort of desolate and gutted after a defeat than Everton for a long time.
Yeah, it was those really sort of typical lying flat out on the grass because you're so devastated shots, which you don't see that often anymore. Maybe playoff finals you see that, because especially the championship one where it feels like you're just so close to that promised land. But yeah, they were absolutely devastated, and they probably thought after they got that equaliser they had a really good chance of winning it, and that belief was just shattered in a matter of minutes. And yeah, it must be really hard to deal with, but they've got to bounce back because the league continues this weekend.
Is Sami Kaufur, Bayern Munich, is that the greatest lying on the floor in anguish after a defeat after the 99 Champions League final? I'm not sure. The agony of it is just too much. It makes me sort of upset if I even see a still image of it. Flo, should Seif had a red card early on? I mean, I didn't think it was a foul, but once the refs gives a foul, then it's got to be a red, right?
On first view, I thought the same, because Lucy Bronze was the last man. She slides down on Hayley Rasso. The referee gives a foul and you think, well, instantly denying goal scoring opportunity should be red card. But actually, when you watch the replay, even though this wasn't what the referee would have seen because she thought it's a foul, what Lucy Bruns does is she gets her foot on the ball, she gets connection with the ball, and then it bounces off Hayley Rasso's shin, and the contact afterwards is what takes Rasso down. So actually it was a pretty well-timed challenge in the end, and in retrospect, if Lucy Bruns had been sent off, it would have been pretty harsh. But it's one of those sort of first looks you think is bad challenge, and actually when you get to watch it on a replay, which obviously referees don't apart from VAR in the Premier League, then you think, oh, it's actually pretty well timed. So in the end, I think it was probably a fair result, and maybe Bronze was also a bit unlucky to get a yellow anyway.
With lockdown two, obviously we know that the Premier League is carrying on, the Championship, we presume the EFL as well. Do we know what's happening with women's football?
So Kelly Simmons was on at half time. She's basically head of women's competition, so she looks after the Championship and the WSL. Championship's the second tier. She was on at half time, and she was pretty committed in saying that the WSL and Championship will carry on because they fall within the elite status. Only issue is that the Championship is part-time, semi-professional, so players are balancing other jobs. They likely may potentially be furloughed. Who knows what the situation is. In a women's sport, we see a lot of athletes who are key workers. So they might be working for the NHS or police or postal service or whatever it may be. So I think that league will be really heavily impacted. And we also see that in the way that COVID spreads, because the majority supposedly of the positive COVID tests that came in the WSL and Championship last week were from the second tier Championship. And obviously they're mixing with a lot more players. You can't really have a bubble or a lot more people because they've got jobs that they need to go to. So you can't really protect them like you can full-time professionals. So I think it's going to be interesting how the Championship does carry on, but hopefully it does, because it's actually really exciting this season. Liverpool, who got relegated, have maintained a fully professional team, aren't walking away with the league like many thought. It's really competitive. Leicester City have just pushed on and announced a fully professional team. Lewis, who have never really challenged, are right up in it as well. And Durham, who aren't attached to a men's team, are also doing really well. And Sheffield United as well. So it's a really exciting league at the moment. So hopefully they can continue.
Let's talk a bit of EFL. Leaders Reading of the Championship lost to Coventry, their first defeat of the season. When did Reading get good, Flo?
It's a good question. I think a lot of their fans may be a little bit surprised, and they felt like the first defeat was inevitably coming at some point, and better now than, you know, later on, I guess, get it out the way. They've got some exceptional players, and I wouldn't say any of the ones that are performing well are any of the new flock. They're players that were there last season or have been there a little bit longer. Zhao, Ijaria, Mate, they've got really good forwards, and they've got a new manager, which is probably the biggest impact. But it's interesting because it comes after a pretty messy summer for the club, and something that's typical for a lot of EFL clubs, really, which is they sacked their manager, Mark Bowen, who was previously the director of football, without even they announced a new manager without even officially announcing the sacking of the previous one. Then Bowen was offered a new role at the club. He rejected it. So there was a bit of, I guess, negative energy hanging around. But the new managers that's come in, Paunovic, has done an exceptional job. And I don't think anyone really had their eye on him as a manager who was going to have lots of success in the EFL. He comes from MLS and youth team international football. So his CV is decent, but not someone who has necessarily the experience of the rugged and brutal world of the English Football League. But he's done so well. And they play really exciting attacking football. But like a lot of the teams in that league, you just leave yourself very open to conceding goals, and that's probably one of their issues. And it's whether or not they have the stamina to continue this sort of form. But they are 4 points clear at the moment, only one defeat. But you've got the clubs that were relegated, Watford, Norwich, Bournemouth, who are sort of quietly doing their business, not conceding a lot of goals, dropping points, but maintaining a bit of a consistency and also having very strong squads. So I feel like those teams, and Swansea as well, who continue to push on, are going to be the ones who might be able to go the distance. But I imagine Reading will still hang around for a playoff spot.
And Marcus, Wickham won.
Yes, brilliant. I'm actually buzzing for the club and the boys. I think it's been coming by all accounts. I think they've had narrow defeats against Reading and Norwich and played very well. And the draw against Watford, who are obviously much fancier than the league, and to beat Sheffield Wednesday, one of the teams that are going to be in and around them at the bottom, it was a massive result. And I think a few changes in personnel and changes in style of play have really helped the team, and hopefully now they can kick on.
Finally, a couple of questions. Tim Smith says, today I tried to show my four-year-old how to dribble. As a starter, we watched Diego Maradona's goal against England in 1986. He said, yes, I can do that. Is there a better, more educational goal I could have picked, does the panel think?
For dribbling, you mean?
Yes, I think a Maisie dribble for a four-year-old. Maybe okay. Juninho, because Juninho was quite small. Or maybe Kinkladze, he's quite short. That Kinkladze City one, because Kinkladze and Juninho sort of have the height of a four-year-old, perhaps.
What about, I think, a compilation of Ronaldinho's greatest moments? Was there a more exciting dribbler than Ronaldinho?
I think the R9 goal for Barcelona, because he had a bit of skill, but he also had that strength, of robustness, to core strength to bounce off people. And it was, probably one of the best dribbling goals from the halfway line. My favourite one anyway.
Oh, George Weah for Milan.
That's a good one, yeah.
But don't you think it's quite hard for a four-year-old to have that core strength, Marcus? I mean, I know you're an elite athlete.
No, but I just want him to know that you need to be, when people get into you, then you've got to bounce them off,
finally, a question from John. Does Barry feel concerned that it's been evident all his sexual flair has been noticeably absent since the Carabao box has been taken off air? How do you plead, Barry?
My sexual flair?
Hmm.
I wasn't aware I have any sexual flair, but and I can certainly line up several female witnesses who will vouch that I have no sexual flair. But if it's sort of my Samson's hair, the Carabao box, I still have it. I can be reunited with it at any time. I know where it is. I don't know if it still functions.
Are you talking about the box or yourself there, Barry? And that'll do for today. Thank you for coming on, Flo. Thanks for that.
Cheers, Max.
Cheers, Philippe.
Cheers, Max.
Cheers, Marcus.
Cheers, Max.
Thank you, Barry.
You're welcome.
We'll be back on Wednesday this week.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.